Hey, what's up, guys? Hope you're all safe and sound. We're going to start another episode of Chá Pedagógico in a while. Okay? So, guys, please join us. We're going to have a special discussion today. Join us in a while. Let's wait and see. There he is.
Hey,
What's up?
I'm here. What's up, man? Good to see
Hey,
you.
good to see you too.
It's
How's it going?
getting too warm. It's getting too warm for us to keep drinking hot tea, you know. We're gonna have to start drinking iced tea.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, brother, but I've been doing this for quite a while.
I know, I know. Yeah, I've done it a couple of times, but I normally just drink hot, warm tea. That's I don't know why. It's just
No,
yeah.
I got it, but because it's too
Yeah.
damn hot, it's been too damn
It
hot.
is. It is.
All
Yeah.
right,
You have
so
no idea. Dude, yesterday it felt like 29 degrees here in Goiânia at 10 p.m.
holy
You know,
shit.
10 p.m. like it feels like 29 degrees. Yeah.
Holy
So,
shit.
you know, when you come here to visit me, you'll see, you'll actually feel what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm having second thoughts now.
Well, you can come in the
Yeah,
winter. There's no winter, by the way,
that's a
so
problem, you know. I could come in the winter,
yeah.
but okay, what's the average degree in Goiás in the winter?
It's like
27.
26 and a half.
Oh,
Yeah.
come on, man. Come
We do
on,
have
man.
a rainy season, so you know, but it rains the whole day. It's not cool.
You have a
It
rainy
does get a
season.
little
You
chillier, but yeah.
have a rainy season of 1 week, right?
Yeah, no, actually, it's kind of like 2 months. That's yeah. You'll see it. You'll see it, man. Yeah.
Okay.
All
Like a like the
right. So we
months
have some people.
the
Yeah.
monsoon season.
Kind of like that. I mean, I think they get it much worse in India or China or whatever that happens. But we're kind of like you know, 2 months in, like at the end of the year, the beginning of the next year.
Okay.
It's really rainy, like a lot. Like it could be equivalent to the monsoon season, kind
All
of like
right.
it, but not with typhoons and you know, like stuff
All
like that. But so, yeah.
right. Okay, so
Okay, man.
as people are joining us, hello everyone. So we have some people
Hello,
joining
hello,
us.
guys.
Prika, hello, Pri. Yumi, hi Yumi, how's it going?
Hello,
Yana,
Fernanda.
Monica, hello,
Welcome, guys.
Fernanda.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for joining this special episode of Chá Pedagógico. Actually,
All
it's a
right.
special episode because it's going to be slightly different because we're
More
going to
technical?
yes, I think it's going to be more technical. And once again, just a reminder, if you couldn't join us right in the beginning, don't worry. This episode is going to be available on IGTV as soon as Andre has the time to upload it. And this episode is also going to be uploaded to Spotify. So we also have last week's episode. We haven't uploaded neither to IGTV
Yeah,
nor
that's
to
true. Yeah. We
Spotify
have
because
to do it.
we haven't had the time because we've been working like crazy dogs lately. But I think, I'll try my best this week to upload it to Spotify. So if you
And I'll do the
haven't.
same with the video.
Yeah, so if you haven't followed us yet on Spotify, because I assume that if you're joining us here, you're already follow us here on Instagram, both me and EDC Rocks. So if you haven't, follow us here. And if you haven't followed us on Spotify, we transformed this episode into a podcast that we upload to Spotify. So you can join us on Spotify. You can listen to it. The only difference is that you're not going to see our bearded faces, but you're going to have
Well,
a
that's an
great
advantage, right? That's the
time.
benefit. And also, you can just listen to us while you're, I don't know, like doing your workout or, well, nowadays you're not supposed to be driving anywhere. So just do it at home, listen to us, and then you can send us questions and hopefully we can talk more about whatever you want. And Hannah, answering your question, it's always tea, man.
It's always
Sometimes
tea.
iced, sometimes iced, sometimes kind of warm, hot tea. Yeah.
Exactly.
So
So guys,
we're going to talk
yes,
about
yeah, today
something really cool.
Yes. Last week, as soon as we finished the episode, we created a very simple poll, and you guys suggested some topics so we could discuss in this episode. And
exactly.
One of the topics that we selected from your suggestion was degenerative diseases.
Diseases, exactly.
And how learning languages can prevent or can help prevent this degenerative diseases.
Yeah.
And so today we're going to be talking about Broca's aphasia, Wernicke's aphasia, Alzheimer, and dementia. Okay, so these are going to be the four topics of today's episode. And this is how this, we said this is going to be a slightly different because it's going to be super, a little bit more technical, but also the format is going to be slightly different because I'm going to talk a little bit, of course, because I'm not a neuroscientist, so I'm a linguist. So I'm going to talk a little bit about language acquisition and how the cognition helps the role of cognition in the process of language acquisition. This is going to be related, for example, to Broca's aphasia. And then Andre is going to talk about the neuroscientific viewpoints of Broca's aphasia. And then right after that, we're going to have this ping pong talk. The language is going to help this, is going to help that. So we're going to do these four topics, and hopefully we're going to cover everything in less than 60 minutes. We're going to try our best to do it all in 50 minutes.
Definitely.
Or so, okay. So the first go ahead.
Yeah. And I just wanted to mention that even though it's a little bit more technical, I think it's really important for those of you who work in bilingual contexts, you know, to understand what language does to the brain and how we have this amazing brain of ours. Because one of the reasons why our brain is amazing is because of language, because we've been able to develop language to the degree that we have. And then it makes a lot of sense that a lot of the stuff that happens to our brains when we grow older, especially when we grow older and then we go through some difficult periods in terms of neuronal plasticity, so we have this natural cognitive decline. So language is probably one of the best, I'd say, determiners or markers to say, this person is going to have something, because there is something affecting this person's language. And because language is such a global process and involves many different areas in the brain, so it's kind of like, you know, that somebody might have some problems in their brain because of how they use language. So language is something extremely important. And then we're going to address those different disorders, right?
Yes, we keep having some yellow flags before we get the red flag through language.
Exactly.
The language is going to give us some signals, and these signals are going, if we pay close attention, then we can prevent a red flag.
Yeah.
So the first topic we selected for today's episode is Broca's aphasia. Okay.
Exactly. And
I would like to start talking a little bit about grammar construction. I know, Rudy, you're going to talk about grammar construction again, just a little bit. Okay.
What the hell, man?
Again, man. Why?
Yeah.
That's what I do. That's what I know. So sorry.
Exactly.
But, how does that work? So when we're babies and we're exposed to the language, we're mainly exposed to very simple languages. We're not exposed to very complex language. And when I say complex, we're going to see that complexity of language is not necessarily the category. It's not necessarily the tense, like, oh, present perfect is complex. No.
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Future perfect continuous. That's complex.
Because the whole idea of complexity of the language lies on the relation of the items that are present in the language. So, for example, So for example,
not the syllabus of a book, right? Because we normally relate complexity to the stuff you're going to start learning when you'll become a C1 or a B2 student, right?
Exactly. Not at all. So for example, passive voice. Passive voice is considered a very complex structure. Why? Because of the relation and because of the symbolic representation that passive voice has. Because we don't have a logic order like I gave a present to John. So there is a sequence. This is a logical sequence. But if we say the present was given to John, this doesn't make any sense symbolically speaking. The conceptualization of this sentence is very complex. And and as we are in the process of acquiring a language, we're not going to be able to create the symbolic representation right in the beginning of the process. Why?
Definitely,
because we're not mature enough to create this symbolic representation. So then what do we do? So we're going to our cognition is going to be responsible for deciding what's easier in the language that we're being exposed to. So basically, our brain, when we're babies, our brain is going to be like, okay, I've been exposed to this sentence for quite a while. And then I realized that present. I understand present. I understand this. This is easy for me. So I'm going to pay attention to this more often. And then our cognition is going to be responsible for focusing on this. And also the order of acquisition is a consequence of that.
Yeah.
And Broca's aphasia, they have patients with Broca's aphasia. They struggle a lot with complex structures, such as passive voice.
Definitely. Yeah.
And they also, and we do have some instances of patient, we do have some patients actually that struggle retrieving verbs. Nouns, they can retrieve more easily than the verbs. Why? Because the nouns are more concrete than the verb, because the verb requires mainly an action the person is going
to see. It's more abstract, right?
Yes. It's also easier to notice. Our cognition pays attention to that because it's a content word, but it requires gestures, it requires some actions happening at the time that something is being spoken. And the noun, we normally have the physical, we have the material, we have something tangible, something tangible. And that's why they can retrieve nouns more easily than verbs.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned how babies acquire language. And I think I've always mentioned, I keep coming back to Patricia Cool. She has a very nice video.
Come on, man.
Patricia Cool. And, you know, babies taking statistics of what we use. Like, I know you're going to talk about formulaic language, right? Like learning from formulas, basically. And, you know, repeated utterances of the language, and then babies will take statistics. You know, this is used all the time, so this matters. And then that's how we acquire language, you know, to a certain extent, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's interesting that you mentioned, so a person with Broca's aphasia is a person who cannot really retrieve certain words. They have what we call a non-fluent type of aphasia because they cannot really express themselves. They take a very long time to form sentences and everything like that. And that has everything to do with the area in the brain where you can find Broca's region, Broca's area, which was discovered by this guy named Pierre-Paul Broca,
Pierre-Paul Broca.
Exactly. And then basically it's in the frontal lobe. So it's actually very close to the temporal lobe. And we call this part the inferior frontal gyrus, exactly. And Rudy has a mini brain there to help us. So it's the inferior frontal gyrus. It's kind of like, if you think about where your ear is, a little to the front, actually, a couple of fingers, and like where Rudy is showing right there. So Broca's aphasia will basically impair your ability to find certain words when you're speaking. So it's all about speech production. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why, again, it's very close to the somatosensory cortex and the auditory cortex. And, you know, for us to make language or to produce language, we're going to have a lot of different areas involved. And it's almost like there's a hub there that connects those things, you know. So there's a little hub, there's a little center there that will connect, you know, the mechanical part of producing speech. So whenever you listen to someone who has Broca's aphasia, they take very long pauses and, you know, they stutter. They try to say the word, but the words won't come out. I'm feeling like Eminem. But the words won't come out. He's choking now. Everybody's choking. So, it's kind of like that because of the area where Broca's area is, right? In the brain. So,
And there's also the case, the phonological aspect of Broca's aphasia, right? Because they can all, they can't produce certain sounds easily either because the Broca's aphasia affects the or motor or movements.
So, exactly.
Because that that area of her brain is responsible for certain movements, or certain movements, not linguistic movements, not for phonology, movements in general.
And of course, the motor cortex, right? It's about moving, really.
So they can also, they can't produce some sounds either. So it's very hard. It's not, we do have speech language pathologists. They do have...
Hello, Carlos.
Hi, Carlo.
Yeah.
So they struggle sometimes, the speech-language pathologists, they struggle sometimes in identifying the linguistic impairment because they have to first confirm if the problem is phonological or if the person can't retrieve the word. Because sometimes, because the person is struggling finding, for instance, or retrieving, for instance, the word, or producing actually the word sneakers. So we don't, the speech pathologists need to know, okay, so the person is struggling producing the word sneakers because of the phonology or because the person cannot retrieve that word. Okay.
Exactly. So, and they're two different things. Yeah.
Completely different things, right?
Exactly.
And
that's
why language, learning a language is really important in preventing that, or even not even to prevent that, as a therapy for these guys. So, because another way to help these guys overcome Broca's aphasia with speech language pathologists or SLPs. Yep. They are going to try to produce sounds like physical therapy sessions, like
la 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 speech therapy, right?
Tra da tra da tra, blah 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 blah. So they are actually going to practice the production of certain sounds, considering, of course, the motor aspect of Broca's aphasia.
Exactly, and again, I told you guys that it's the inferior frontal gyrus. That's the area in the brain. And it's in the frontal cortex, right? In the frontal lobe, actually, which means that it's very close to not only the hippocampus, but also if you go a little upward inside the brain to the working memory capacity. And those are two very important structures for us.
Don't spoil.
Yeah.
We're gonna use working memory and episodic memory and all these things later. Don't spoil.
Exactly. So no spoilers. Thank you for warning me. But I just want to mention one thing. So it's kind of funny how we come across, like how we find out those problems, you know. So Pierre Paul Broca was actually studying two patients who had some kind of damage in this area. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people with brain damage could be a trauma to their heads or a stroke or something like that or whatever. Mm-hmm. They have actually made a huge contribution to neuroscience because, you know, neuroscientists at the time, psychiatrists, they were able to study their brains and make assumptions of, okay, this person who has a normal brain except for this damaged area is demonstrating or showing some very interesting effects of something that is going on inside their brain. So that means that this area of the brain is probably responsible for that. And that's how we also found out about Wernicke's aphasia, right?
Yes, exactly, which is the second topic today, Wernicke's aphasia. Wernicke's aphasia is when a person has a neural lesion. This is my brain again. In the left, well, I don't know if my image is mirrored, okay? So let's assume that this is the left temporal lobe, because I don't know
It is the left, yeah. It looks like the left, yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not mirrored, right? Okay.
No.
My image is not mirrored. Okay, so this is the left temporal
lobe. Right
there. And this is the temporal lobe, okay? Kind of like the temporal. Of course, there's my finger, etc., but this is the left temporal lobe.
Kind of like, like here, you know?
Exactly, yes, yes.
Yeah.
So what's going on with this temporal lobe that is so important? This temporal lobe is responsible for semantic aspects of the language.
Yes.
Meaning. And we all know that languages are all about meaning, conceptualizations, words, chunks, etc. That's why I called your attention or attention to formulaic sentences, because the formulaic sentences are the basis of every kind of spoken language. We do use formulaic sentences or prefabricated. I don't like to produce this word because it's so hard. I prefer formulaic or prefab.
Formulaic makes sense, but because it comes from a formula, it's kind of like a fixed sort of, you know.
And it's also easier to pronounce.
Yeah. Much easier. Yeah,
I don't have Broca's aphasia, okay? If we consider the process of language acquisition, we do conceptualize all these formulaic sentences. Why is that? Yesterday, I was giving a webinar for Brustiesel, and I was talking about cognition, the process of language acquisition, and how does that work? For example, if we go to the dentist, and I'm going to use the same example. If we go to the dentist and the dentist says, open wide, we don't break down the sentence when we're going to either understand or use it. We see open wide as a big chunk, as a big block, as a big meaningful block. So how does that work? So when the dentist says, open wide, we do have a symbolic representation for this combination of open and wide. And we we do this. Okay. So that's what we have. All right. So we do have a symbolic representation of that. And what does Wernicke's aphasia have to do with this? Remember, I just said that the left temporal lobe is responsible for semantics, meaning that meaning representations. You know, meaning that meaning.
Exactly.
Okay.
Meaning. Semantics means meaning, right?
Meaning.
Exactly.
And then the person that has a Wernicke's aphasia, this person, maybe this person understands what's being told, but this person is going to struggle a lot to understand what's being told to this patient. And there's one more thing. When this person needs to retrieve the symbolic representations, they can't.
Yeah.
And which is worse. Yeah.
They have a fluent aphasia, right?
Yes.
And
they don't know. They have no idea
exactly
that they are not producing what they're thinking that they are.
Exactly.
So basically, a person with Wernicke's aphasia wants to retrieve a symbolic representation of open wide. But for some reason, this person cannot produce that. And these patients, actually, some of them, I mean, the ones that have a severe Wernicke's aphasia, they produce noises, not sounds.
Noises. They actually use made up words, you know. They come, they create words and
so
and
basically,
noises, exactly.
Yeah, so the person, imagine that the person is a dentist and this person, this patient is used to saying open wide because it's part of his or her job. And then this person has an accident or a stroke, whatever, and this person cannot produce it open wide anymore. So the brain has a hard time retrieving that this concept of open wide, and the person is going to say like blah 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 blah, seriously blah 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 blah.
Exactly. Blah, 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 and blah. And you know, and it's a very interesting again to mention the area. So if you go back, so kind of revisiting Broca's area, mm-hmm. inferior frontal gyrus, right? And then again, it's responsible for speech production, basically. So the whole mechanics of language, like moving, because it's very close to your motor cortex. So it has to do with moving your apparatus, let's say, you know, your mouth, mm-hmm. your tongue. It has to do with your vocal cords, but also finding the words, true. But with Wernicke's area, which is in the temporal lobe, it's the superior temporal gyrus. So kind of like where Rudy's showing there. And this has to do with meaning formation, symbolic representation, right? So basically what we want, I mean, when a person has Wernicke's aphasia, they can speak fluently, but made up things. They think they're retrieving the meaning of the words that they want to say, but they are not. And maybe they cannot even understand what we're saying. Maybe they can. It depends on the level of the aphasia. So maybe whatever I'm speaking now, if you had this kind of aphasia, you wouldn't be making any sense of what I'm speaking. And then when you wanted to say something, even though in your brain, it sounds like you're using the actual words in the right order, you're producing language quite fluently, you are just, you know, uttering a bunch of mumbo jumbo, basically. Yes. It doesn't make any sense, right?
Yes, yes.
Absolutely. It's kind of, I have an analogy for this. It's kind of like autocorrect. No, imagine you're learning French or whatever, because French is really hard to spell, right? So if you have Broca's aphasia is like you have no autocorrect. So you have to remember how to spell the words before you send a sentence. And the more complex, the harder. It takes you a very long time to kind of find the words and type in the right letters. But Wernicke's aphasia is like, you know French, but autocorrect keeps changing everything for you. So you're typing in the words and autocorrect keeps changing. So the result is like nothing makes change. Nothing makes sense, right?
Yes.
Kind of like that.
Yes. Yeah, that, but that's a great analogy, because Wernicke's aphasia, that's exactly it. And the PhD proposal that I've been working on is related to that. I mean, the intention is preserved, okay, guys?
Yeah.
But as it's exactly what you said, Andre. The intention is preserved. The pragmatic aspect of the language is preserved, is saved.
Exactly. Okay?
But the production doesn't match the intention. The production doesn't match the intention. And the worst is the person doesn't know that. But going back to speech language pathologists, SLPs again, one of the therapies that they have for these guys, these patients with Wernicke's aphasia, is to paraphrase. Because what's going to happen? So once again, we do have our brains here, and the temporal lobe is affected. Let me just make something clear here, because it just came to me. We're talking about specific areas of the brain. Because we're talking because we're talking about degenerative diseases that affect parts of the brain. This doesn't mean that we believe that when we're speaking or when we're exposed to language, we only use a specific area, okay? Just make it very clear.
And to add to that very quickly, we're talking about specific areas of the brain, because we're talking about specific features of language. We mentioned the motor cortex, you know, the mechanics of language, speech production, and we also mentioned semantics. Representation, right?
Yes.
Symbolic representation. We're talking about a language is far more complex than that, so it involves many other areas, right?
Yes. I mean, I we needed to make it very clear to say that because those guys who have been following us, they might ask us, Rudy, Andre, you're always telling us that we use the whole brain, etc. Now you're talking about specific areas. So no, guys, it's because we're talking about diseases that affect that affect specific areas of our brain. So once again, so the person has the left temporal lobe affected because of Wernicke's aphasia. What's going to happen? The person is going to use the other side to compensate.
Exactly.
All right. So what's going to happen? The person is going to use the other side of her brain to compensate. And paraphrasing is going to help that. So when we practice with patients with a vernix aphasia, to paraphrase, so the person cannot say open wide. So maybe the person cannot say open wide, produce open wide. So this person is going to use the other hemisphere of the brain to say,
to compensate, right?
To compensate for that. And the person is going to be able to say, all right, so please open your mouth to the full extension.
Yeah. Something like that. Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
So this is one of the therapies. And again, this is why language is really important. And again, Andre is going to talk about this more details in 2 seconds. In 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Because the brain is like a muscle. I know it sounds cheesy, but it is. What do we do? Why do we have to work out? Why do we need to work out our biceps or triceps? The muscles we have in the back, because the more we work out these muscles, the bigger the muscle is going to be. So if we have language therapies or speech therapies, therapies, not therapists, therapies with these patients, we are going to force these patients to work out the muscle called brain.
It's like physical therapy, actually.
Yes,
and you mentioned, so this is really important. Rudy mentioned something, but we don't want you guys to go out saying that the brain is a muscle, but the brain works like a muscle.
Yeah.
Like most of the time, because the brain is an organ. It's a very important organ that takes up, 25% of all the energy that we consume, the brain uses. So the brain is made of tissue and fat and arteries and veins and vessels in general. But the brain is not a muscle. The brain has a lot of muscles. But the idea is that the more we use the brain to do something, the easier it will get for the brain to do that. And that has to do with something called long-term potentiation. So it's more like when there is a sentence that kind of summarizes that. It's neurons that fire together, wire together, basically. So the more we use a neuronal network, the easier for us to get to that neuronal network and retrieve the information that we need. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, it's kind of like working out your biceps, it gets bigger. It's easier to lift things in the future when you're working out. So it's easier for the information or, the chemical substances, the neurotransmitters, and even the electricity that goes inside our brains. It's easier for it to travel because you have stronger puffed up, six-packed neuronal networks, that.
And it's true. The brain is going to be six-packed because it's going to have more.
That's the idea. Abs, serious abs.
And that's why, and that's why language is plural now. It's really important because the more we use the brain, the stronger it's going to be because of what you have just said.
Yeah.
So imagine we've been using one language for 5 years, assuming that we start learning a second language at age five. So we've been using the same language for 5 years, and we've been working out.
Yeah.
Air quotes, you're working for Spotify. Air quotes.
Exactly. Okay? Yes.
So we've been working out this muscle here, one exercise only. And then we start learning English.
Another language,
Yes, English, for example. So it's like we're not going to stop that activity. We're not going to stop with Portuguese. We're still going to work out the muscle using that exercise. But now we added another exercise. So, course, the brain is going to use different parts. I don't want to say different parts, but anyway. So because I'm thinking about the muscle, because our muscles have different parts, smaller parts, et cetera, that depending on the activity.
Sometimes the exercise, same part, but in different ways,
Exactly.
So it's the same muscle, but in different ways,
Yes. So let's suppose that for the brain, when we're speaking Portuguese, which is our native language, we are we're activating this point, and two different points on this hemisphere.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
choosing random
hypothetically,
points,
yeah,
choosing random yeah. points, all right?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
we start learning a different language, English, for example, which is a second yeah. language. So we're going yeah. to use points 1, 2, 3, and now 4, 5,
and some
six,
others,
and
yep.
7 on the yep. other side of our brain.
Exactly.
So you
exactly.
see how we're going to work out the muscle, but in a different way. So that's yep. why language is really, yep. really extremely
and, actually. And we can see, and we can see that if we look at some studies that involved executive functions, right? So this is very important. So because we're talking about neuroplasticity and keeping our brain young and healthy and, you know, working out and whatever. So if you look at how executive functions go in the brain, like the frontal, we're talking about the frontal lobe, the prefrontal cortex, kind of like the, yeah. So right behind your forehead, basically. So that's your prefrontal cortex there. And then it has a lot to do with executive functions. And executive functions, they are very important for everything, basically. We have three types of, well, three major types, not just, but we have one major type that is about inhibiting. So we need executive function to inhibit certain behaviors. Mm-hmm. We call that inhibitory control. We have mm-hmm. one that is about updating. That has to do with the working memory. So it's getting new information, processing, consolidating. And we also have one that is about shifting, kind of, you know, distracting. And that can also be called cognitive flexibility. And that has a lot to do with neuroplasticity. And
yes.
So what is neuroplasticity? It's basically the brain's ability to always learn and always create new neurons. And kind of people like to use this expression. It's not really that, but rewire itself. It's kind of like creating different networks. So what happens? Every study, there are a bunch of studies. There's one by Bialystok, for example. Mm-hmm. There was one in India. So Bialystok did with like almost 200 subjects or something like that. And they compared monolingual brains and bilingual brains. They were still alive, by the way, guys. They just put them inside an fMRI machine or something like that. Nobody had to die for the experiment. But they were checking activation in the prefrontal cortex because it has to do with executive functions, right? And the one in India had more than 600 subjects. And what they realized is that bilinguals, and when they control for all the other variables, so nothing else could have influenced the result. It had to be the factor of being bilingual or monolingual, right? Bilingual brains, they can fight off or delay the onset of dementia, so neurodegenerative diseases, by 5 years on average. And that's pretty cool. And we don't really know why, but we hypothesize that it's because of this executive functions, the gain in executive functions, right? It has yeah. to be related to that. Because if you're exercising this inhibiting, every time I have to say a word in English, I'm inhibiting my Portuguese. So
yeah.
that's a good workout for the brain, which means that I am protecting my brain, for on average, I'd say 5 years more.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
At the end of my life when I'm going to develop this disease, right?
Yes.
Which is awesome. So being bilingual buys you like another 5 years or 6 years or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So I hope you're all you are all experts on aphasia right now. We're going to talk about Broca's aphasia and Wernicke's aphasia.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about Alzheimer's, which is our point number three, and we're coming to the end of this episode. Wow, it's coming to the end of this episode.
So let's talk about it, man. I love
all right.
it. So now I can give the spoilers, right?
now it's the moment for all the memories of the world. So when we're learning a language, we have something called joint attention that plays an important role, an essential role in this process. What is joint attention? Yeah. Meaning that a baby is going to pay attention to everything that's happening in front of this baby, in front of him or her, and this baby,
especially the caregiver, the parents,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, imagining that there is an adult doing something. So
yeah.
Imagine this scenario. There is an adult doing something, and this baby is in the same room, okay? And this baby is paying attention to what's going on. So this joint attention, like the baby paying attention to the parent and the parent paying attention to the baby, hopefully, all right? This is going to play an essential role in the language acquisition because, because through this joint attention, the baby is going to realize, and then again, executive functions again, they're going to make some analysis, and this baby is going to be like, oh, so whenever the person says something, the intention is blah, blah, blah. So whenever the person, for example, I'm going to use the same example I used in my webinar yesterday. So whenever the parent is saying, let's put the cereal box up here. So the baby is going to pay attention to, for example, up here. Oh, so up here. So whenever the person says up here, it means a place, a high place, for example.
Yeah.
And we do have a lot of people saying that attention is the gateway of cognition. Why is that?
Because
we do have some, I'm going to mention some types of attention that we have. For example, we have selective attention, meaning that the baby is going to focus on a specific stimulus, like the parent getting the cereal box and putting it in an upper shelf, for example. And then we have for example, sustained attention. The sustained attention is when the baby keeps the focus on a specific stimulus because it's interesting
for a certain period of time.
Oh, this is so cool. Like us, we still do that. When we're watching a very interesting movie, for instance, we pay attention. For instance, yesterday I was watching Money Heist or La Casa de Papel. All right.
La Casa de Papel.
La Casa de Papel.
We just finished the season today.
Me too. So okay. It was interesting. So I was really paying attention. So my
sustained attention
was really activated at that time. We do have divided attention. What is divided attention? So, for example, we do have a baby and the baby is multitasking the attention. Yep. So I'm going to pay attention to the gesture of the parent and also to what the parent is saying.
Exactly. Or maybe a sound that is coming from the background, the TV is on or something like that.
Whatever.
That happens to us all the time. Yeah.
Yes. So that's what we call attention, the gateway of cognition. And for language, this is really important because this is what we're going to do to learn words. And then we're going to retrieve the word based on the episode that we were living in or the situational aspect that we're in.
And, you know, since we're talking about dementia and Alzheimer's disease, I'm very glad that you mentioned attention because I must have said a couple of times, but attention plus memory equals learning, according to Eric Kandel. He was the one who studied the sea slug because they had just a couple of thousands of neurons, so it was easier. We have like 86 billion neurons, and the sea slug, because they are not that smart, they only have 20,000 or 25,000 neurons. And so if we require attention to learn, because first, we have to receive a stimulus from the environment, and then we have to pay attention to it, and then we are going to store it in our short-term memory system or working memory system, and then we're going to consolidate it all over the cortex. What is dementia then? What is Alzheimer's disease, and what happens to the brain? So this is not really happening very well. This system of, you know, so there's a very simple kind of consolidation model that was introduced by Atkinson and Shiffrin, I think in the 1960s. And it's kind of like this: sensory memory, very quick. And then we pay attention to the stimulus coming. at us, you know, from the environment, and then we send it to the short-term memory, and then we rehearse that. So we retrieve that, rehearse that, and then we send it to the long-term memory, right? Mm-hmm. And one very important structure related to that in the brain is a subcortical structure called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is kind of like the elevator. I always use this analogy because I think it's kind of, it's easier to understand. It's, you know, if you want to go to the top floor of a building, you have to go through the lobby, right? And you have to talk to the receptionist. That's like your sensory memory, kind of, you know? Actually, the entrance of the building would be the sensory memory because it takes you like 2 seconds to go through the door. And then the reception, it gets like 10 minutes, 15 minutes or something like that, till, you know, somebody says, you can go up. And then you have to go up. That's where the long-term memory storage is. Mm-hmm. How do you get there? The hippocampus, the elevator. So the hippocampus brings you to the top floor, but also brings you back to the working memory, to the lobby, to the short-term memory. Mm-hmm. What happens to people who have dementia, because dementia is a group of diseases that we have in our brains, mm-hmm. that are also known as neurodegenerative diseases because they degenerate the brain and they are incurable. We don't have a cure for them, but we can delay them, you know, if we are, for example, active, healthy, bilingual, you know, and a bunch of other things. Multilingual, right? So yeah. You will see if you cut a person's brain in half, and then you look at a healthy brain and a person with Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia, right?
Yeah.
You will see that their brain kind of shrunk a little. It's smaller.
Yeah.
Especially, so you have a huge hole. So if you cut the brain in half like this way, you're going to see right in the center of the brain, there should be like a two small holes where you would expect to see the limbic system, the hippocampi, right, on both sides. And then you have a huge hole there because it's almost like something ate that part, you know. And it has to do with accumulation of a certain protein. So there are many things that we're figuring out now. And why, again, is it important for us to keep an active life and for us to learn new languages? Because that's going to give your brain cognitive flexibility. That's going to help your brain transit from L1 to L2 to whatever language you're using.
To whatever L.
Keep your brain, to whatever L, that's going to keep your brain healthy. That's going to help your brain delay the onset, the early symptoms of the dementia, all types of dementia, basically, right?
Yes. And when we're learning a second language or a third language, when we're learning a foreign language, a language that is not ours, whatever L we're learning here.
Whatever L, yes.
Whatever L. What do we do as soon as we're exposed to this language? So this language is going to be included in the short-term memory. Why is that? Because it's new, right?
So yeah.
It's new. It's brand new. So we're going to use this, and we're going to store that in the short-term memory because we haven't had time yet to use this information frequently enough in order to make it more automatic. So it's there.
Exactly.
It's in the short-term memory. And then as we keep practicing and practicing and practicing, that's why practice in the classroom is really important, okay? We're going to get this information, this linguistic information, removed from the drawer of short-term memory, and we're going to include it in the long-term memory. And then in the long-term memory, we do have two options, I'd say, okay? Or two subcategories, subcategories. We have the episodic memory and the semantic memory, right? And when we retrieve words, I'm going to talk about words, not necessarily structures, because I think it's going to be simpler.
Yeah.
And it's going to be easier because we're talking about Alzheimer's, for instance, okay?
Exactly.
So when they have a problem in retrieving the word, and we're talking about Alzheimer now, okay?
Yeah.
Why is that? Because that person has a very hard time accessing the episodic memory and the semantic memory.
Exactly.
So this person has a hard time accessing these two subcategories that is now part of the long-term memory. That's why when we're learning a language, we're basically practicing or making this muscle, this part of the muscle, stronger.
Stronger,
because we're constantly accessing it. We're constantly accessing. It's like an old bike. So if we don't use an old bike, the chains are going to be rusty after a while.
Exactly.
So if we keep using this bike, the chains are not going to be they're going to be rusty. We have to maintain that, but not as fast as if we weren't using the bike.
Yeah. And again, you mentioned two types of memory that are very important for us to understand what happens to an Alzheimer's patient, right? So you said episodic memory. So we have many types of memory. If you guys, Google memory types, you're going to cry. Yeah. There is a book by Gazzaniga, I think was his name. And so it was neuroscience and psychology. And then there is a very cool memory chart that you have basically two big types of memory in the long term, because we have the sensory memory, short term memory, working memory, and then long term memory, which is subdivided into a bunch of other memories. But we normally have, I think the easiest way to understand is that we have something called declarative memory and non-declarative memory. And declarative memory has to do with stuff that we can declare, that we can verbalize, and also has to do with, so therefore, conscious memory. It's a type of conscious memory. The other one, non-declarative memory, has to do with unconscious memory. So it's stuff that we do basically automatically, right? So habits and it's processed in a different part of our bodies. Could be the somatosensory cortex or the cerebellum or whatever. But like Rudy said, semantic and episodic memory, they are both declarative memory. So they're the type of memory that we can verbalize. And when you see somebody with dementia, they have a lot of trouble retrieving that kind, though the two types of memory, especially episodic, because they start losing a little bit of who they are in terms. They start losing memories, you know. And we know that, and Rudy and I have discussed this many times, when we create meaning in the brain, that's experience dependent, you know. You have to go through something has to happen. You have to have an experience for you to attach meaning to whatever, like the baby and the father trying to put the cereal box on the top shelf, right?
Yeah.
That's an experience. That's a memory that you create. And then you're going to draw from that huge neuronal network, and then you're going to attach a lot of meaning to whatever happened. And that's where you're going to find the word cereal box or up here or whatever, the chunks you're going to find attached to that neuronal network. And with Alzheimer's patients, they are losing that. They're losing memories. They're losing their experiences, the stuff that they have gained through life. And they're losing a lot of neurons in their hippocampi, which means, and then again, they're not making new memories, because the hippocampi, they are the elevators taking our memory to, you know. So that means that even new stuff, they can be paying attention. Yeah. But then the transition, like sending it to the long-term memory storage, that's not happening very well. And not only is that not happening, they're also losing a bunch of memories that they had already created, right? So that's why dementia is terrible, guys. It's something that makes us lose our identity. We don't know who we are. We get lost. You know, the hippocampi has been, they have been related to navigational skills, navigational memory as well. Yeah. And also there's a theory of lack of visual processing. So Alzheimer's patients, they're going to start wondering about on the streets, because they have no idea where they're going, or maybe they have no idea who they are and what they have to do. So even the intention, Rudy was talking about the intention is not really preserved there, because they don't have an objective. They lose it. And it's sad. It's really sad. But this is something that happens to a lot of people around the world, right?
Yes. And the whole point, we have only 5 more minutes, and I promised you guys that we were going to respect the time today. So the whole point of learning a language. So I don't know if you've all had the opportunity to watch the Avengers, not the Endgame, but Infinity War, when Thanos snaps his finger, then a lot of characters, they start vanishing, disappearing.
Yeah.
And so imagine that dementia or brain snapped the finger.
Exactly.
And the whole parts of her brain, the whole informational system is vanishing little by little, little by little.
Like
and
chunks,
yes.
Chunks of our brain. They disappear, right?
And then when we start learning, when we learn and study other languages, it's our brain saying, no, I don't want to vanish now. I'm not ready to vanish now. So it's like a tug of war with the snapping of the finger and learning.
It's the Avengers, man. I loved it. This is a cool analogy. You know, learning a second language is like the Avengers trying to stop Thanos, you know? Like,
exactly.
That's the idea.
All right.
Yes.
just to ask a question that Gabriela asked a couple of minutes ago. If we know Ricardo Souza from UFMG, I'm sorry, but I've never heard of him before. She said that Ricardo is a reference, in phonology and phonology.
Cool. Awesome.
Good to know, Gabriela. Yep. I haven't heard of him before. I'm going to Google him, and I'm going to see what he's produced so far. But thank you so much for this for this reference.
And B. Joma said that they have to finish watching. That's okay.
Yeah. So let's wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up, man. Right. Again, I hope this was not too technical, because we used a lot of jargon today. But I think the final message here is that first, the brain is really plastic. And I think our brain has gotten to this stage of evolution because of language. Without language, we wouldn't have gotten this far, which means that language is fundamental. It's at the heart of cognition for us, for humans. And that, of course, if we know more than one language, we're going to preserve our cognition for a longer time because of cognitive flexibility, right?
Yes.
So it's kind of like Rudy said, knowing another language is like having the Avengers inside your brain fighting off Thanos, you know, trying to prevent the snap.
Just for the record, I'm Rudy, okay? When he says Rudy, I'm Rudy, all right?
Yeah, because
I can
Rudy.
See that. Yeah, I can see that some people are joining. A lot of people right are. Now. I'm Rudy, okay?
He's Rudy, exactly.
If you like that, I'm Rudy. I said that.
But that's it. I think that we need to tell people involved in bilingual contacts and teachers and educators in general the importance of language learning. It's not just for communicating, but also protecting your brain. And, you get a bunch of cognitive gains from learning a second language, guys. Mm-hmm. Tell your students that. They should know that,
Yeah. And the adult learners as well, because the young learners or teenagers, they'll look at you like, I'm too young to learn. I'm too young for this information. But adult learners, they'll start being worried about the whole thing about dementia, aphasia, and all these things. So, guys, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you're all safe at home. Stay home.
Stay home.
Stay home. I know it's hard. It's been hard, but stay home. If you haven't, joined us since the beginning of this episode, this is going to be uploaded to IGTV and Spotify. Follow us here on Instagram, on Spotify. Andre, thank you very much, brother.
Thank you, dude. And we're planning the next one. So keep up with us, guys. Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, guys. Bye.